Okay, I think we're going to get going here. So welcome, first of all, to the panel on plastics. Just like the old movie, plastics, one word. But I think we'd all agree that this is an incredibly timely topic, certainly with the iconic image of the National Geographic. By the way, the National Geographic folks have declared this already as one of their most iconic covers of all time. As you may know, they are also sinking a ton of money into actually an advocacy position on this, which is one of the first times National Geographic Society, now that it's split with the National Geographic Magazine, if I've got that right, is undertaking. Pardon me?
Partners,
yeah, right, with a lot of money involved. Because it's a great issue. You may have seen also, like a week or so ago, the young guy from Europe was taking the ship out from San Francisco Bay out to try to gather up the ocean debris. But he was also criticized for that. Well, we'll talk about the legitimacy of an idea like that, or whether it's just more fanciful than anything. But there are so many topics that I want to cover today. And I know a lot of you have covered the issue of plastic as well, so I'd also like to make this a conversation among all of us, too, because you have a lot of information and insight to contribute as well. So we have a really, really terrific panel. Some of the topics that we'll be covering is plastic, microplastic in the food chain? Is leaching an issue with plastic bottles and other plastics in our consumer feed? How do we clean up the oceans? How do we prevent it from getting into the oceans in the first place? What do we do about biodegradable or decomposing plastics? And what does that actually mean for the recycling industry? We have a recycling expert here as well who's going to give us insight from the front lines in that area. And also, I'd like to talk about whether it's in our food chain now, whether it's in us, and how do we know that, and what do we do about it? These are really probing issues that I'm sure all of you can find localized opportunities to cover this issue. I think it's an incredibly important story, and I think all of you do too, which is why you're here. You have probably seen the intro and biographies from the panelists, but I want to introduce them at least quickly. Faye Park is president of USPIRG. You all know that as journalists, a public interest research group. And Dune Ives is the, is it Ives or Eves?
Ives.
Ives, okay, right. Is president of The Lonely Whale, which is a really terrific organization based in Seattle, but they do work all over the world focusing on ocean plastic and marine debris. Dirk Assendorf is an old friend of mine, and we're really fortunate to have him. I had been looking for a European angle to this story, because we often work on these major problems in a cylinder, but all we have to do is look across the pond many times. But are the European countries doing anything that we can learn from? Are they doing better than we are, or not as well as we are? Dirk is a terrific journalist from Germany, and he's written extensively on the issue of plastics, and he's going to bring us the European perspective.
He's very red.
Pardon?
He's very red right now.
He's very red.
He did a good job.
And getting redder now that we mentioned it. Roger Cargill is our, I think he's going to present a fascinating angle. He's with a company and himself is one of the nation's leading experts on plastic recycling, sustainability in that regard. And he has a very localized experience in Flint, too. And he's going to talk a little bit about his experience with plastic bottle recycling in Flint after the water crisis, or during, depending on how you look at it. By the way, just to be clear, Roger is not a representative of the plastics industry. We did invite the plastics industry, and they got back to me eventually and said, we just can't find anybody available at that time, Saturday at 9 o'clock. Such as it is, we did invite them. We really did genuinely want them to be here to have that dialogue, because there is a pretty steep criticism that the plastics manufacturing industry is pointing the finger at consumers that don't recycle, and in fact, perhaps they should be pointing the finger at themselves for not stepping up enough on the manufacturing side. So what we're going to do is each panelist is going to talk for just a few minutes. I'm going to ask one, maybe two questions after their opening comments, and literally we're going to open it up for questions from you, so please get your questions ready now. I always hate that awkward silence when you ask for the first question. We wait 10 seconds before someone can speak up, so get your questions in your head right now. Let's just go right down the road, since there's really no particular order I have here. I'll turn it over to you, Faye Park.
Okay. Hi. As Jeff said, I'm the president of USPIRG, which is the National Association of State Public Interest Research Groups around the country. I'm also the executive vice president of the Public Interest Network, which includes not only the PIRGs, but also the state network of groups like Environment Michigan, Environment California, Environment America. So I'm going to draw on our experiences on both sides of that as we talk about plastics. The first thing I want to say is I want to make sure to acknowledge that plastics, there's a lot that's miraculous about plastics. They're cheap, durable, strong, and because of those things, they have been revolutionary in terms of public health, et cetera. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that, because to fight the crisis of plastic pollution, we have to come up against that fact of life. Unfortunately, we humans have ignored the maxim, everything in moderation, with plastics, and guided in part by the very smart marketing and entrepreneurialism among the plastic industry and also the petrochemical industry, along with basic human nature's drive to get more of everything cheaper, faster, more conveniently, we have created a throwaway culture that didn't really exist 100 years ago. We now have a one-way pipeline of extract, produce, use, throw away, repeat. And that one-way pipeline is resulting in ever-increasing piles of garbage, islands of floating plastic in our oceans, and belching incinerators that are spewing toxic plumes of smoke. We need to break that linear one-way pipeline. And the solution to that is the very simple three R's that we've been talking about for decades, reduce, reuse, recycle, better than the original three R's in that the words all actually start with R. There's a reason why we say that in that order, because that's the order that we need to tackle this in. First, we have to reduce things. We have to reduce our reliance and use of plastic. The PIRGs have been very active at the state level and the federal level, doing things like, banning plastic bags, straws, all the things that have been getting a lot of attention in the last few years. We have to reuse things, and a little twist on that is we need to not only reuse things, but we have to extend the life value of the products that we use. One relatively new avenue that we've been pursuing is right to repair policies that would require that manufacturers of things like phones, farm equipment, et cetera, make it possible for the buyers of those products to actually, open this up, replace the battery instead of throwing it out and, throwing out $1,000 to buy the latest iPhone. And then finally, for whatever plastic we're still using, once we've exhausted the value of that, to actually recycle it. And we need to invest more in our recycling infrastructure and make sure that we're keeping all of those materials out of the landfills for as long as we possibly can. To grease the wheels of that whole reduce, reuse, recycle triangle, every policy, everything we can do to shove responsibility for dealing with all this stuff once we've exhausted their value towards the front end of that pipeline, the shifting responsibility to the producers and to those the consumers who are making the initial decisions to buy things and are, making it economically attractive for the producers to create these things. The more that we can do that, the more all the lifestyle changes and industry changes that are required are likely to happen. And Europe, I'm excited to hear about, hear from, I'm never going to get your name right. I'm sorry. Dirk. Dr. Dirk.
Okay, Dirk.
Because Europe has really been leading the way in shifting responsibility to the producers and manufacturers, and there's a lot that we here in the United States can learn from that, and hopefully their work there will make it easier for us to pursue that. So the thing that I really want to emphasize is not just the, how do we clean up the plastic once it's there in the oceans and, in the recycling facilities, how do we capture that, but how do we stop it from getting there in the first place by reducing our consumption and reducing our reliance on the plastic in the first place?
So I just want to ask you to talk a little bit more about your battle in California with your team, and I presume it was the plastics manufacturing industry. Is there a plastics bag industry? I've actually never lived in a locale where they've fought as viciously as they seem to have fought in California.
Right.
And what were their ads like? Like, we want plastic bags.
Well, it was more nefarious than that, really. Because who would think that there's a plastic bag lobby, but it turns out there is. And their names are so benign, I can't even keep them straight. It's like the American Progressive Bag Alliance or something like that. But this
freedom of choice.
Yeah, right. My organization has been working on solid waste plastic issues for decades. The floating garbage patch, the Pacific patch, that first started getting a lot of attention in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, really set the stage for state level environmental groups like Environment California and CalPERG to take advantage of the awareness and public education and do something about it. We started off using bag fees, placing a tax on those reusable grocery or not reusable the disposable grocery bags as a way to get consumers to opt out of using the plastic bags. We filed a bill, not just us but a coalition of organizations. The industry came in and convinced the legislature to pass a statewide ban on bans, and so that kind of pulled things out from under us. And just to kind of get into the recycling aspect of this, but it also, as part of the compromise, required that grocery stores accept the plastic bags back to capture those into the recycling stream. Not surprisingly, that didn't work at all. We started then in the mid-2000s filing a bill to just ban bags outright, and the legislature just kept defeating it. We would line up the votes, and in the last, several days of the session, whatever they're called, the American Progressive Bag Alliance, would come in, lobby, and peel away our votes so that we would repeatedly lose. I'll speed this up. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. But can I ask you specifically, what did the legislators say when they defended their position?
Well, everything from...
In favor of plastic bags.
Yeah. Right. Freedom of choice. There's always sanitation arguments that reusable bags are going to be a breeding ground of bacteria. They can always cite some study from somewhere funded by industry to support that. It's going to be a pain for the grocers and the retailers to have to to not be able to provide the bags. And against the bag tax, it's people on discretionary incomes can't afford to spend the 10 cents per bag. Mm-hmm. So it's arguments like that. Or also another one at the time was at the time, California was in a budget crisis, so it was like, why is the California state legislature spending time worrying about plastic bags and litter when we should be tackling our budget crisis? So it's also kind of, this is a trivial issue.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Can I just say one last thing?
Yes, you can.
Okay, and that's that after 8 or 9 years of filing this bill, we finally passed it, and the main reason why is that local cities were taking action. At the end, over 140 cities, including San Francisco, and the key one was Los Angeles, passed their own local bans. At that point, the grocers came on board to our side because they were saying, we can't deal with all these laws in these different places. It would be easier. You guys are essentially, the tide is turning, and so let's just do this at a statewide level because it'd be easier for us to implement.
Yeah.
One last chapter to this story is that the day after Schwarzenegger signed the bill, I think, the plastic bag industry announced that they were going to petition and, in fact, did pay the millions of dollars to collect the signatures to qualify two measures on the 16 ballot, which we won, but it meant that the law wasn't going to go into effect for 2 years, and we had to divert our time and energy and our resources to winning those ballot measures.
And yes or no, is it your understanding that the plastic bag industry, is continuing to fight similar laws across the country,
yes,
or have they kind of given up?
They have not given up. It's sort of fascinating to see how these things evolve, but I was just talking to Doug O'Malley, who's our director of Environment New Jersey, just a couple of hours ago. We're running an omnibus bill in the New Jersey state legislature to ban single-use plastics. And he was saying that strangely, or at least I think it's strangely, that while the plastic bag industry, they were not very present, but the polystyrene, better known as styrofoam industry, they were the ones that were kind of going all out. Mm-hmm. So I don't, I'm not exactly sure what that means in terms of the plastic bag industry giving up.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you very much. Dune,
yes,
talk to us about what you guys are doing, and your focus is on marine, or is it, or would, what did you, is it terrestrial as well?
So hello, welcome. It's nice to see all of you. I'm Dune Ives with Lonely Whale. Our organization is 100% focused on single-use plastic pollution reduction. It's interesting because when we got started as an organization, it was just about 3 years ago. And I had just come off of 3 years working for Paul Allen, developing his global environmental philanthropy portfolio, which was where Jeff and I originally met. And what Paul's key question to me always was is, you know, as a philanthropist, he knew he could continue to spend millions, if not billions of dollars trying to solve for environmental issues. But at the end of the day, if people actually don't care about it, it doesn't matter what we do as policymakers or as business leaders or as philanthropists. At the very core of our environmental issues is care. Care for our community, care for our environment, care for marine animals, care for elephants, care for something other than our own self within this particular moment. So when I left Vulcan and joined Lonely Whale, I found that question actually really able to be fully understood and leveraged. And our theory of change at Lonely Whale is if we act and talk not like an environmental organization, but like a brand, like a corporate brand, if we hire the firms that brands hire to do all of their marketing campaigns, if we show up like a brand, if we perform like a brand, does that allow us to actually change the conversation and allow people to want to get engaged in ocean health issues, and in particular want to get engaged with plastic? And the reason we selected plastic as our core issue that we wanted to focus in on, and should we go to the slides?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, do you want me to go up there?
Sure.
I just have a couple of slides for you. But the reason that we focused on plastic is when we started, we didn't have an organizing principle. We didn't have a core threat to the ocean we wanted to focus in on. We just knew we wanted to connect people to the world's ocean, and by doing so, maybe we could solve for some of these environmental issues. Is on somewhere. But the reason we decided to focus in on plastic instead of deep sea mining or slavery on the high seas or ocean acidification or you name it, right? There's so many ocean health threats. But we focused in on plastic because it's the one thing that connects us together every single day. You actually can't escape plastic in your daily life, whether it's for good plastic. So if you're in the healthcare field or you have an elderly relative that has diabetes, you come into contact with plastic constantly. So there's plastic that is really good, but then there's also single-use plastic, and that's what we're really focusing on. So we knew that every single day we're connected to single-use plastic. In fact, annually, there's about 300 million metric tons, actually more than that, of plastic produced globally. It's a lot of plastic. And while we think in the United States, and we think globally, that most of that plastic is recycled. In fact, let me just do a quiz of all of you. How much plastic is recycled globally on an annual basis? What's the percentage, do you think?
9%.
What were you going to say in the back?
4%.
9%? Who else has an idea? 5?
2.
2? It's a bunch of cynical people in here. I like it. It's 9. Globally, it's 9% of plastic produced is recycled. Most of us actually think, and I'm going to show you a slide. Oh, I know how to do this.
Okay.
This I know
there,
how to do.
In there.
Okay, good. All right. 1 second. Then we'll go to view. Full screen mode. Okay, plastic, blah, blah, blah. Less than 10% is recycled, so right around 9%. But in the United States, we just completed a poll because we really wanted to better understand what are people's perceptions of single-use plastic water bottles in particular, really interested in water bottles. And within the water bottle space, what do they think is recycled? So just look at the top bar up here nationally, and this is a nationally representative sample. But nationally, the majority of adults think that plastic water bottles are recycled. Well, we know, what's the stat in the United States? It's roughly, like, in the United States, I think it's somewhere between 32 to 36%, depending on the stat you look at. So it's, what is happening is reality and our expectations are not lining up.
right? So we think that we drink water from this reusable water bottle. If you're in Michigan, it's probably recycled, depending on how you get it to the recycling center. But the rest of the country, it's not. So we let ourselves off the hook every single day, right? And by doing so, we utilize more single-use plastics, and we continue to put forward the system of extraction, production, utilization, and if you're lucky, recycling, but for the most part, it's not. It's probably going to a landfill, or in some parts of the world, it's going to get burned. So what we've realized through the work that we've done over the course of the last year is that as an organization, we have to start shifting our expectations about what normal is. So most of you, if you know Lonely Well, you know us for our straw campaign. So we launched a campaign that we affectionately called Stop Sucking.
Hashtag Stop Sucking.
Because it was funny. We actually got a lot of criticism in the NGO community for being so outlandish with our campaign title. Boomers are never going to say stop sucking, they said. And I said, I think that's not right. I think they're going to say it a lot. Turns out they did say it a lot. Within the first 3 months of our campaign, it had gone to more than 40 countries, and it became localized in 25 languages.
Wow.
So even though stop sucking doesn't translate in French, I mean, it does. It's pretty vulgar. So that it was appropriate to share with children. So there was something about the campaigning, and what we realized at the end of the campaign is when Kim Kardashian got called out on Instagram for having most of the world's plastic pollution in her family's refrigerator. For us, we were like, that's it. We just culture hacked this.
Wow.
Right, because now what we did is we opened up a conversation with probably one of the most watched people in the world. And somebody pointed out, one of her very famous friends pointed out, they use a lot of plastic pollution. So we work globally. We work with almost, so in just a few weeks we'll be making a pretty big announcement about two more companies that we're working with, but we have a consortium of companies under the banner called Next Wave.
Wait, you can't say that in front of a bunch of journalists.
If you want the embargoed press release, I'd be happy to give it to you in about a week and a half. I'll give you my card. But what we're doing with Next Wave is we're bringing companies together to try to stop the flow of plastic into the ocean. You know, most I think in this room have heard that it's those five Southeast Asian countries and it's these 10 rivers. And if we could just stop plastic coming out of those countries, then everything will be good. Well, that's this picture here from India, right? Kids walking on top of plastic and other trash, single-use plastic bags, diapers, I mean, you name it, flowing into the water, and once it gets into the water, it's almost impossible to extract. So as much as I love Boy and Slat, and as much as I want the Ocean Project to work, the Ocean Cleanup Project, like it has to work, I also recognize that we have to put systems in place to be able to capture this material. So Next Wave is trying to do that with these global corporations. So we're working hard, but we also recognize that the plastic pollution crisis is in our backyard. This is an image in Santa Monica. Go to any community around the United States and you're going to see this. Some of you probably saw the research that recently came out of the University of Georgia identifying the amount of plastic in the bellies of baby sea turtles, 5-day-old sea turtles that essentially starved to death because of the amount of plastic in the bellies. They couldn't make it all the way up.
5 days old.
So microplastics are showing up everywhere. It's not just in Southeast Asia. It's not just in India. It's not in Africa. It's in Santa Monica. It's in Michigan. It's in the Great Lakes. Everywhere. What are the reasons why we think that those images have become new normal for us? Is when we look at the water, well, let me ask you, when you look at the water, what do you think? Just in general. You look up at the river, well, Flint may be very different. Okay, so not in Flint, as an environmental journalist, but when you look out at the ocean, what's some of the images or the feelings, the emotions that you get?
Peaceful, healing, you know, the sea.
Natural.
That's right. Yeah. Right. It gives you good vibes, right? You calm, you relax. When you think about going on vacation, hopefully you think about going somewhere where there's water and you can go swimming, maybe you can snorkel, because it replenishes you. What you don't think about is the amount of plastic that's in the water, right? And the harm that it's causing. When we look out at the water and we see plastic on the surface, like this, off the coast of Sonora in Indonesia, it doesn't look that bad, does it? It kind of looks like maybe somebody's garbage bag fell off a boat. But only 5% of what is in the water is on the surface. This is what it looks like on a daily basis in most parts of the world these days. where you have beautiful pelagic creatures swimming through plastic, filter feeding this plastic. So 95% of what's in the ocean is under the water, is under the surface. Once it gets into the water, it breaks down into microplastics, which most of you probably already know about. Those are very difficult to extract. They're very tasty and attractive to fish. So what we've started to learn more is that we're probably eating plastic, because plastic is showing up in the fibers of fish, or is showing up in fish flesh.
Can I ask you a question, though, while you're on the topic? You said we're probably eating plastic. I think journalists are hesitant to say we're eating plastic, because I keep hearing different perspectives of that. What is your understanding of the latest science?
So two things I will say to it. One is, we don't have enough data to make everybody really comfortable. Right? So we've got one study that shows if you're European and you eat fish, chances are, in shellfish, you are eating 11,000 particles of plastic every single year. So that's one thing. That's one thing I will say, is we need more information so we all feel comfortable. The other thing I will say is that no matter how much data we have or don't have, I think we can all agree that plastic doesn't belong in the ocean. Hmm. How many studies do we need to say that it's bad for turtles to mistake a plastic bag for a jellyfish? We need zero studies for that, right? They aren't supposed to be eating plastic. And if even one more study comes out, like we had showing the amount of plastic particles in our drinking water from our tap in developed worlds and undeveloped worlds that has plastic particles in it, just one more study to confirm our belief that plastic is getting into our water sources, that should be enough for us.
Why isn't that happening? Why aren't we getting those studies? Or are they underway?
They exist already. We know that every sample of sea salt tested around the world has shown plastic particles.
Yeah.
Do I still use sea salt to season it? I tell you I use Himalayan sea salt. Because in my mind I think, well, maybe that's a little bit better. I think part of it is, why aren't we talking about climate change anymore? Why aren't we talking about environmental degradation like we used to? There's so much bad stuff in the world, and I'm a psychologist by training, so how much more bad stuff can we handle? How much more can we process as individuals? Which is why a lot of us are actually starting to work upstream, right? So what Faye is saying, you're seeing a lot more coming out Monday, I believe, or on the 9th, whatever day that is. Greenpeace is going to be releasing their brand new brand audit. So they went to 42 countries in September. They did beach cleanups, which I think beach cleanups are probably the worst thing that anybody can do to save the environment, because it lets us off the hook, and there's all these bright, shiny faces, happy, smiley people who wear similar t-shirts, and they have barbecues, and they do the beach cleanup, and we're like, cool, good, clean. But we haven't solved anything, right? So now they're taking these beach cleanups, and they're turning them into brand audits. This is one brand audit from a year ago, didn't get covered at all in the press, from Malaysia, looking at five beaches over the course of several days, and which brands show up? And why do those brands keep showing up? Why do these brands, why does Nestle, when Nestle knows that their products are getting into the marine environment, they know that there's no infrastructure in Malaysia, why do they keep selling products in Malaysia that have no end of life possibility for them? There's no recycling, there's no reuse of this material. Why do they keep doing that? They keep doing it because they keep making money. So what you're going to see from Greenpeace and other organizations is you're going to see a big push for more of these brand audits. You're also going to start seeing, and this is one of those things that we now need to start talking about, this just broke in the New York Times, hopefully we'll see more reporting on this as well, is about the inextricable link between greenhouse gas emissions and plastic production. Since we started our straw campaign, and since the first straw campaign began, the petrochemical industry has put $194 billion into new oil and gas extraction, primarily for plastic polymers.
What was that?
$194 billion. Primarily for plastic polymer production.
Can I just ask, are you being recorded for...
Yes, this is being recorded.
Okay, I just wondered if she needed a mic.
It probably will work okay, but let's just do this to be sure.
$194 billion.
It's awesome what you're saying.
And so this is a system that has been created to last. Plastic is the most perfect product on the planet. It is cheap, it is lightweight, it was meant to last forever.
while there are circular economy conversations happening, and while there are NGOs and others that are really, you know, starting to raise the alarm bell to say, we have a moment here, we can turn this back. If we don't, by the year 2025, we'll have 1 ton of plastic in the ocean for every 3 tons of fish. Are we okay with that? We shouldn't be okay with that, right? We should be mad. We should be outraged. And we should get up and we should do something about it. So for us, going back to the straws, we decided, let's give everybody something to do every single day. Are banning straws going to make a difference? No. No. It's not going to make a big marginal difference. But the point wasn't to make a difference on plastic production. The point was to wake people up, right? So why aren't people thinking about it? It's too big. Jeff, when I think about 300 million tons, metric tons of plastic produced every year and only 9% is recycled, I kind of give up. I don't even know what to do with that stat. But when I think about if I can get rid of a straw, or if I can not have that single-use plastic water bottle, or not have the styrofoam cup or the lid, there's plastic all over, right? If I can make a choice every day as a consumer, while others are starting to raise alarm bells and starting to fight on this system and start to make a difference, well, then I can feel good, right? And I can be part of the solution.
What about the and we have to move on to Dirk, but what about the parallel between cleaning up the ocean beaches and this versus the straw? Are you worried that people are going to think, well, I'm saving my straws, so I don't have to do anything more?
So the nice thing about the straw that we really like, and also about the beach cleanups that we do like, is it builds community. So we know as an organization, you know as an organization, we can't solve this issue by ourselves. We have to work together. Environmental NGOs are not great at working together. Right. So when we look at some of these small asks, easy things to step forward in, what it does for us too as environmental NGOs is it helps us build community and work together and find that space where we can really truly collaborate and we can take a big stand together at some point. So every organization that worked on the straw campaign is also part of the Break Free from Plastic global movement, which is over 1,500 organizations working together to develop a strategy on how to reduce single-use plastic pollution globally. So they build community and they bring us all together.
And SEG brought you two guys together, so maybe you can work together.
We will. I already have an idea.
Who knows? Dirk, if you had to put a headline on where Europe or Germany stands in its in addressing the plastic issue, what would that headline be?
General population would believe that we are quite good. And if you look into it deeply, you find out that we're actually quite bad. You have that chart I put on the computer? Because I wanted to say that this plastic issue, I mean, it's on the rise in the media as well in Europe over the last years. And this is the chart. It shows, but beware, this is an algorithmic scale. So this is the climate change. The scale is algorithmic, so don't be misguided there. It weighs out the others. But then this is particulate matter, this is plastic waste, this is microplastic, and this is glyphosate. So they range in the same level of coverage in the media now. And
in Europe?
No, this is Germany. This is the major German publication, media, print and online. And well, I was part of that for Die Zeit. It's here. This one stands for Die Zeit. And I've done several stories on it, on microplastic and on plastic waste, recycling standards and how they are met or not met and so on. And this year we did a large collaborative effort. It did a title story of 4 broadsheet pages on the whole chain of plastic in Germany. We went out like 5 reporters to cover all steps the plastic takes from the production to the use to the, well, where it ends up and then the incineration, and we even went into the mine where the dust and ashes that remain after incineration are deposited that contain these additives that pose a major health threat if it comes to plastic. So because the plastic itself normally doesn't pose a health threat, it's not poisonous, but the additives are poisonous that are in the plastic.
And
what really has tricked me when we did that is that they still, even though we have recycling laws on plastic in Germany for 30 years now, there's still so many open questions. we have, I put together a flowchart like to accompany that story, and we have 15 million tons of production, of use of plastics in Germany every year, and only 6 million of plastic is collected as waste. Now you wonder, there is 9 million tons remaining, where are they? I mean, part of it is clear, it's in construction, it's in paints, it's in export products. I mean, we export a lot in Germany. I think this has been a matter in the US as well. that it was too much. A lot of that obviously is explained by these chains, but not everything. I mean, there is still large open questions where this plastic actually remains. And when I did, I just wanted to say one more thing that really was striking me when I did the research, that when we speak of microplastic, this iconic plastic bag that always comes to our mind, well, this is a nice icon, but it's far from what the real problem is. Yeah. If you look at microplastic, it's the by far largest amount of microplastic is not secondary microplastic, which means plastic bags and plastic things that become crushed and more crushed end up as microplastic. This is not the main, this is only a third or so, a quarter. The larger part, by far larger part, is the primary microplastic. And the by far largest source of these microplastics in Germany, at least, and I think in the US must be even more, is tires and road surface scratched off. Mm-hmm. So this outweighs all other microplastics. When the cars go on the road, the tires, they are, how do you say that?
It
leaves stuff to the road, and the road surface as well. There is stuff, and in the road surface there is also plastics, because it comes from recycling industry and they use it and so on. So this is going into the rainwater. That rainwater takes it wherever it goes. If it is in cities, it's collected, goes to the wastewater treatment plants. 95% of microplastic is recovered there, but it's recovered in the sludge. And where does the sludge go? The sludge goes to agriculture. So you end up with a lot of microplastic in the agriculture, which explains why there is so much, because you do a testing and you find there is a lot in the soil. You wonder how did it get there, and this is one explanation. But there are still like all of these questions, if you really look into them, there are so many open questions still. And well, it's true that one can act without answering all those questions, obviously. You don't have to, but still, as a journalist, I'm always interested to find these answers, and there's still a lot of work to do, and also for you, I mean, this can be localized in each and every place. Like, just ask the question, where does the microplastic come from? Is that known to government, to local government?
Last question for you. Are there examples of municipalities or perhaps the federal government in Germany that are doing or trying to do things that we are not doing that surprise you? Like, what can we learn from what Europe is doing?
Well, as I said, we have plastic recycling laws, especially on packaging, for 30 years now, and they have proven to be not very efficient. We still have a rise in plastic packaging. At the beginning, they were meant to reduce the use of plastic packaging just by putting a price tag on it, because each and every manufacturer has to pay a price on bringing plastic packaging into the market, and that price depends
the price
on the material used and so on and so on.
Yeah.
So the expectation was that might eventually diminish the amount, but, well, it did not happen at all. It's still on the rise. The use of plastic packaging is still on the rise. And I think this is the major lack in our policies, that we have a lot of policies. We have 10,000 paragraphs of laws on waste treatment in Germany and in the EU. But we don't have a single law on the use of these materials. Mm-hmm. So the use is not limited. And I think now, after 30 years of experience, it's so clear that just putting laws, but just putting legislation on the recycling will never be sufficient.
Interesting.
What we need is a policy on the use. We need a tax or whatever, a policy that really makes people feel that they use too much.
Yeah, which they do. Fascinating, Dirk. Thank you very much. And I can't wait to hear from Roger, because my first question to you is recycling the answer?
Absolutely not. I mean, it is. It goes back to Faye's discussion on reduce, reuse, and recycle. It's actually the third thing. If you look at the EPA hierarchy, it's up there, but it's not the answer. It's a like everything. There's several answers to one problem, right? Mm-hmm. But for my perspective, or our perspective, I come from Chupan Recycling. That's who I represent here. We represent glass, plastic, and aluminum in the beverage industry. That's captured in glass.
Okay. These are just recording. Yeah.
Glass, plastic, and aluminum in the beverage industry in Michigan. Although we buy nationally and manage plastics, glass, and aluminum nationally. So just to give you a perspective, I don't know how many of you are from Michigan and how many of you are from the 9 other bottle bill states, but that's the perspective that I come from. I've been in the industry for about 28 years, and I focus on public space recycling as my expertise. So I do NASCAR, large concerts and events and promote recycling.
Which is you do SCGA?
Really? I totally agree. You know how hard it was to get SCJ to stop using plastic? I mean, it was just unbelievable.
I was just.
Yeah, right.
I'm so thirsty right now.
Do you want to share?
So true. Let's do that.
I would like this is plastic that. As well, but it's reused.
Yeah, right.
Dozens of times.
So, can I ask you a question? What, in a perfect world, what would you like to see plastics manufacturers do to make your job simpler? Please show them. You can use our water bottles as samples too.
Every manufacturer is trying to make themselves stick out from behind.
Could you hold those up in the air so our people in the back row can see them?
Every beverage manufacturer is trying to stick out behind the glass door, right? They make the LED lights in there extremely bright, so everything looks bright and beautiful in it. So you have to stick out if you're going to sell your product. And when that happens, it oftentimes means a multi-material product. So that all that means is every time you add a different kind of plastic, metal, whatever you add, from our end, we have to figure out how to manage that. So alone in a water bottle, you've got three different kinds of plastic. The bottle is PET, the label is polyvinyl, and the cap is polypropylene. Start going with this one. There's at least five. So the challenges are even reaching an alternative to water, right? So how are we going to manage this?
Yeah, we love it when you hold stuff up.
I even brought you.
Like deer in a headlight.
Yeah. So it's really good to
So this is a simple aluminum can. And Michigan is a great example of it because our craft beer industry is going crazy. It's cheaper for them to have plastic labels applied to aluminum can than it is to print on the aluminum can.
Wow.
So if I were to ask the industry and extended producer responsibility to go back and say, look, end of life is extremely difficult. We have figured out how to manage this with great ease. For all of you that don't know, this container would be collected, shredded, and then the three different kinds of plastic have different specific gravity, so they float off. And we can do a 90-95% sort and cleaning of it. And it's right back in the beverage industry. Everything that goes through Chupan Recycling that has a potential market, meaning everything but this stupid label on it, and that's 76% of our waste, goes right back into the beverage container industry and is made back into a bottle, all but the label. And Verner's, our local Detroit company, is now producing label-less bottles. They're printing specific, right directly on the PET. So that's fantastic move, because we would like to figure out a way to market our 76% labels.
Who's doing bottle to bottle in Michigan?
Pardon me?
You're not downside, the bottles aren't, the plastics, the PET isn't downside, but it's bottle to bottle?
Sure. There's about, there's, well, CleanTech in Dundee, Michigan, mm-hmm. is probably the biggest in the Midwest in managing that. So we take this type of product, this type of material, and we take it to a flake or a bale, and then we sell it, and we do not clean it. We do not take it to the next step, so ours is called Dirty Flake.
Is that called PERF? Plastics MRF that handles, never mind.
We could be considered that. Uh-huh. I mean, that's a pretty vague term.
But it's pretty rare to go bottle to bottle. Most PET is now cycled into fiberfill and carpeting.
I would tell you that if you collect material from a material recovery facility, a MRF, mm-hmm. you have between 11 and 22% contamination. That's the only place that material can go. If you collect it through a bottle bill, yeah. which there's 10 states in the U.S. that have a bottle bill, and a number of new bottle bills being incorporated everywhere but the U.S.,
yeah.
for a good reason, the material is incredibly clean. We have 4 decimal points that we have to of contamination. 4 decimal points that we have to have that so clean. It is so clean. There's not a piece of ferrous metal in it.
You mean your contamination rate is ..
Yeah. Okay. But that's actually demanded by the industry because this bottle will have between 5 and 15%, depending on the company, mm-hmm. will have between 5 and 15% recycled content. Mm.
So single stream recycling is...
Sucks. Right?
I mean, yeah.
Sucks.
Keep sucking.
Yeah.
Stop sucking.
Sorry.
That's a perfect transition into questions. And I had hoped to have more time for questions, but this has been so good, I didn't see a need to transition out of it into questions, but now we can. So let's let her rip. We'll start with you, Sharon.
Skip the 30-second gap.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about either...
Sharon, could you say anything?
Oh, my name is Sharon Geinup. I'm a finance journalist. I live in New Jersey. We haven't talked about either... really good alternative products mm-hmm. or the health impacts of petrochemicals, plastics. And I wonder if any of you would like to address that.
Who wants to take back?
I can talk to products.
Okay.
So when we think about solutions in this space, and we think about McDonald's amazing announcement around 100% sustainable packaging by 2025, and we think about others that are trying to get there, back to what Dirk said, right? No matter what the policy is, if the solutions aren't there, if they're not coming forward, then we're not fixing the system either. We're not seeing very many amazing scalable solutions to plastic our way out of where we currently are. That to us is a phenomenal opportunity, right? So when we think about just even straws, there is one straw that I would recommend. Hmm. If you have to use a straw, and you don't have a disability, and many people do, but if you don't fall into that category, and children do not use straws, they do not need straws. We have parents all the time saying, but our children need straws. We're like, no, you think they need straws, but they actually are capable of drinking from a cup. Like, it's good. Like, that's a whole OT thing. Drink, help them, learn. But there's only one straw. There's only one straw manufacturer that we feel like has the ability to scale, and they have the right product. That's a problem when already we've estimated that by the year 2020, if no other announcements are made, we'll have already removed 8 billion straws from the planet. There are no good biodegradable plastics. There are no good compostable plastics. That is a fallacy. Mm. If they get into the water, they act exactly like plastic. Making plastic from food, not a great idea, right? All it is a Band-Aid solution. It's not fixing the problem. So we need more packaging solutions.
Yes. Name and affiliation.
Sure. Hi, I'm Judith Hank. I was the EPA Regional Administrator for Region 2 during the Obama administration, and I currently teach a class on plastic pollution at Bennington College. You're all invited to Bennington, maybe in the fall, sitting on my class. Mm-hmm. And I think you touched on a lot of the key issues, but what I'm also noticing is, you know, we obviously can't recycle our way out of this problem. We have to have upstream source reduction solutions. But as awareness grows, thanks to National Geographic, other media outlets, the garbage incinerator industry is moving in and saying, don't change a thing. Keep your straws, keep your multi-material packaging. We can burn it all. And I just think reporters need to be alert to that. I've noticed there are new Covanta advertisements on CNN. And if not citing new incinerators or extending the life of existing ones, which are a major source of carbon pollution, they don't eliminate the need for landfills because of the ash, et cetera. What I've noticed in upstate New York, there's also a big push to burning garbage and plastic in existing cement kilns. So this is kind of a perilous time. I think public awareness is growing, and you know, there are 400 local plastic reduction ordinances on the books and growing almost every week. But we can either take a turn toward real source reduction. We definitely can kind of update recycling, but that's not going to solve the problem. But the money is going to be on burning it all, and we need to be really alert to that.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm from Vice News Tonight.
I'm sorry, what?
My name is Sarah. I'm from Vice News Tonight. Okay. You showed our climate coverage. I'm curious about one of you could maybe speak to. You mentioned it briefly about the links between the petrochemical industry and the plastics industry. And I feel like the conversation often is like, you know, the consumers and the food industry or the packaging industry. There seems to be a lot of kind of conflict between those two, but it seems like both of those industries are not really turning around and saying the reason that we have so much plastic is because it's so much cheaper to produce virgin plastic than it is to produce recycled plastic. Even so, in that kind of upstream, I'm curious, like, what are the solutions or what are the innovations that are going on to actually either make recycling cheaper or to make petrochemicals more expensive, reduce subsidies? Like, is that just an untouchable realm?
Okay, who's going to touch on that?
First of all, the industry killed ourselves 15 years ago when we felt like nobody was going to pay for recycling. So we called it free, and we hid it in the trash costs. So to make recycling cheaper, it isn't. The same truck, the same fuel, the same benefits to that driver, the same everything it costs to go down that road to pick that stuff up. It's a very expensive process. And it's complicated even more by in the U.S. You're sitting in a state that has a 14.9% recycling rate, and that's even arguable.
Okay. Let me hear from Faye real quick. Want to finish up your thought?
So that to me is a concern of general public. They want to make recycling cheaper. They want to make it efficient, and they want to dumb it down. And we've done that.
Okay.
Just to go back to my point about we have to start with reducing what we're using. It's sort of like a balloon animal where you squeeze one part of the balloon animal and the rest of the body gets bigger. In addition to the worry that people are going to come along and, or the incinerator industry will come along and say, this is what we can do with all this plastic that China's no longer going to take, you also have the argument and you can turn it into energy. So that also solves the problem of fossil fuel extraction. And it's just...
And poor people in developing communities.
Right. So it's... at the scale that we're talking about, any quick fix, anything that sounds like a quick fix, it's like a gigantic... I mean, people have said this before, but it's like it's like an experiment, except it's not an experiment that's contained inside a lab. It's the planet. And once the economic shift... So if the news about the plastic floating islands of trash in the oceans cause a tipping point such that we do tip over into going back and trying to incinerate our way out of this problem, there absolutely are going to be problems elsewhere. So even talk about bioplastics in alternatives, you just have to assume that 10 years down the line, we're going to realize that those things actually cause some other insidious form of cancer. So I think what we really have to come to grips with, we live in a throwaway society. I know everyone says that. We all know that on some level, but we've got to scale down immediately as fast as we can.
Yes.
And to do so,
your name and affiliation.
My name is Barbara Lucas, and I'm a freelancer out of Ann Arbor. And I am interested in stopping it at the source. You've all mentioned that it's too cheap. There's so many things that we do that if it were more expensive, we wouldn't do it that way. And Dirk has mentioned fees. That's one way. I mean, traveling throughout the world and seeing how the fees have worked so well in other places. But it seems to be such a hard sell in the U.S. and wondering how you feel about just, pricing carbon in general and having things like that be petroleum be more expensive. But then some of the carbon pricing schemes say that the plastics would be exempted from the price on carbon. I don't know if that's the case. Have you guys looked into that kind of solution for this problem?
Anybody?
I mean, there certainly are conversations happening around pricing. There's a lot within that question. You know, there's challenges in the U.S. that are challenges in the U.S. unlike other parts of the world. Our current administration, the lobbying industry. I mean, the International Association of Water Bottlers. There are some really big industry associations that are really trying hard right now to hold on tight to the past. Even just take Washington State. So we have an initiative 1631, which is 100% clean energy initiative that the people really want. The polling looks like we really want it. Governor Brown just signed something similar in California. So what is the oil and gas industry doing? They dropped $21 million on the no on I-1631 campaign. Why do they do that? Right? Who doesn't want 100% clean energy? Well, the oil and gas industry doesn't want it. Why don't they want it? Because they figured out with natural gas extraction, they've got this beautiful gold mine, this byproduct that they can sell to create plastic polymers. And we're all asleep at the wheel. We don't realize that this is made from oil and gas. And so, cool, we're just going to keep using single-use plastics. So I think part of what's happening right now, too, is that there's this desire, you know, when the disease starts to die, it starts looking like, you know, crazy forms of things you never expected under the microscope. I think that's what we're seeing, too, is so much money being put into keeping it the way that it is and holding on tight to that.
It's all about money.
It's an economy.
And I can't wait to see the TV ad for that campaign either.
Oh, God, it's crazy.
And I doubt whether a higher price on carbon emissions would reduce plastic use. I think it might even increase plastic use.
Yeah.
Because plastic is an extremely good material. It's very lightweight. It, like with a little foil, you can pack so much. Imagine, like, what are the alternatives? There is a very nice life cycle analysis comparison between milk sold in glass bottles, which are then taken back. You call it a bottle fee, I think. Huh? Oh, it's a deposit. You pay a deposit and you get it back when you bring the bottle back, against a plastic, it's like a plastic tube, which is just sealed on top and on the bottom. We had those in the 70s and 80s. They have vanished from the market because somehow industry felt that consumers are not very, that they don't manage them well, and then they spill milk and so on. But they are by far the best packaging. Like when it comes to full life cycle analysis, they outweigh by far the glass bottle with a deposit system. Because the glass bottle is so heavy to transport, and then it consumes a lot of water and detergents to clean. And if you take all that into account, this plastic tube is by far the best packaging. So I would also warn, plastic per se is not a bad thing. It can help to reduce carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. It's just a matter of, like, getting it right, not like producing things like this, where you then have all these plastics mixed together. So I doubt very much whether a carbon price would change anything there.
Yes, question.
I'm Omar Hasenbeck. I work at a daily newspaper in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And obviously we're a landlocked state, so it's very hard for me to localize the Pacific Garden Patch. And so you mentioned tires and how that shreds. So I was wondering, what are some other story ideas that you could farm and localize really easily with microplastics or plastics that you can't see?
Well, there's plastic and microfibers. That's an easy one to localize in Colorado. And just because you're landlocked doesn't mean you aren't part of Oceanic. You know, there's the Inland Ocean Coalition that's actually based in Colorado. That is really leading the charge to make sure everybody everywhere, when you have a river, that ultimately goes out to the ocean, right? So there are things that you can do to kind of show the connection. But plastic microfibers, thankfully the United States passed the plastic microbeads ban, but there's more work to do there. I just recently saw, as part of the International Energy Association report that just came out, that the New York Times referenced in that piece that I showed you, talking about how much plastic is actually in our laundry detergent. So there are things in our home, even looking at how much plastic you have in your home, toothpaste tubes, shampoo bottles, the sponge that you use to clean your dishes with. So I think that there's a lot that you can do to localize it within your community, but I would encourage you to expand that as well and be really comfortable expanding it to take the localized approach. Right, and how does what happens within Colorado and even Steamboat Springs, how does that affect the rest of the planet?
There's also, obviously, people, I live in Denver, the people in Colorado are such big outdoor enthusiasts. There's the, you know, what is happening with all the plastic that we produce and what's that contaminating? And then with the, you know, more and more of the outdoor kind of recreational clothing, Patagonia type industry.
All those microfibers.
Yes, a lot of the clothing and products that they create are using recycled materials, so there's that angle. And then, by the way, that our organization, Environment Colorado, is introducing a bill to ban polystyrene in the upcoming session.
Yeah. Great story.
Which will have ripple effects across the country. I mean, we need that inland to be able to take it elsewhere.
Loosely related, REI just unveiled that they will resell their used products. So it's an astonishing notion that a company is giving you an alternative to buying their new product and instead buy their used product. It's pretty interesting. Patagonia does that as well. Yeah, Carolyn.
Yeah, Carolyn Wetzel, independent journalist in Southern California. And I just wanted to add on to what Faye was saying about the California bag ban. It's the organization that is fighting those across the nation is the American Progressive Bag Alliance, and it's funded largely by a company named Helix Poly, a South Carolina company named Helix Poly, but I think they have a new name called Novalex, and they're also in South Carolina. Mm. But they basically were the major funder of the fight in California, and there were multiple lawsuits to challenge the city and county bans, but they all failed. And that's and because of the number of, like Faye said, the number of local bans led to the state legislation. But a key part of that legislation was the support of the supermarkets. Mm-hmm. And the 10-cent charge for the bag, a portion of that goes back to the store. So that helped when the bag ban. And what I find most amazing to see this in use is the number of people who refuse to pay the 10% and walk out with boxes of groceries.
what city was that company in?
It's in South Carolina.
Any South Carolina reporters?
It's in South Carolina, yeah. And I think it's called, what's the website called? Plastic. I would have to look it up again. Yeah. Plasticindustry.org.
I often think that the manufacturers are these nameless companies that, you know, we don't really know about because they're B2B, and of course their customers we know about, Nestle and whatnot, but they seem to be like in the shadows so much. It'd be fascinating to do more stories about them. Did you want to comment?
Just two things about bag bans, which, you know, like straws, you kind of go, well, really, it's just a drop in the bucket. But two things. Number one is I do think that in addition to bringing different environmental groups together and, you know, just the notion that everyone in, you know, in Colorado, California, these places where you make the switch, at first it feels like this insurmountable thing of like, mm-hmm. how am I going to get my groceries home? But it doesn't actually take that much effort to make that switch. And so I think in the, you know, in the big picture struggle is to get people to remember or we hear stories about what things used to be like 100 years ago before plastic really became mm-hmm. popular. It's not actually that huge a switch lifestyle-wise to mm-hmm. switch back to the way things were not that long ago. And then the second thing, because this is just, it just reveals how insidious the Progressive Bag Alliance industry efforts can be. When I said that there were the they qualified two ballot measures to essentially repeal the bag ban in California. So one was just an outright repeal. The second was, okay, if you all vote to uphold that law that was passed, then we want to take that 10-cent bag charge for if when you go to the store and you have to still buy a bag. Instead of letting the grocers have that 10 cents, let's use that to set up an environmental fund to, I don't know, like create more open space park. So it kind of sounds good, but that second measure, the reason they did that was to try to peel the grocer's support off of that first mm-hmm. measure. So, you know, and imagine trying to get millions of California voters to go to the polls and understand you have to vote yes on this bill and no on this one for this all to work. So very, very tricky.
I would love to mention the conference room when they were plotting that. Can I just get a couple of quick questions?
Can I just add one thing just on this? So picking up what you said about, you know, what these straw and bag bans do, they do allow you to see success. They do allow you to see a new normal. What they also do, and this is, you know, can I ask for help from this group?
They may not give it to you, but that's you can fine. Ask.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I love to see, and I call them the sassy articles, I love to see the sassy journalist articles. I love to see the headline that says, straws, that's not really the problem. Uh-huh. Like, I love that, because I think what the straw and the bag bans do is it causes us to start looking around to say, but what is the problem? Like, what is that? And there's nothing that we love more than to see somebody go, oh my gosh, Lonely Well, you guys had no idea what you're doing. It's not straws, it's these 10 things. We're like, uh-huh, cool, keep it coming, right? So keep like digging in and focusing in on what is the problem, where does it go? Because people love plastic. They love talking about plastic.
Yeah.
They love the plastic pollution fight. And I think what that does is it fuels the conversation, and we need more of that to really help give lift to a lot of these efforts. Without it, we can't do it.
When you're at a place like a conference like this and somebody hands you a bottle of water, how do you personally dispose of it? Do you feel guilty? Do you look for the recycle bin? Do you put it in your car and think you'll start a recycling business on your own? You know, this is anxiety that's running under everything, every meal, you know.
I carried this from Germany.
You carried that from Germany?
Well, it's produced in China, though. But it says made in China, but I got it in Germany. I brought it here. I filled it up.
I brought my nice mug from Denver, and I left it at the restaurant. Yeah. And it's somewhere among my five friends and colleagues, and I have to get it back.
I brought my Spal, and I filled it up at the hotel. And then I was like, should I have filled it up at the hotel? Is there lead in this water? Should I drink a plastic water bottle? Like, honestly, like, what did I just do? Am I going to have lead poisoning?
But it's just once. It's just once in your lifetime. It won't hurt you. I mean, the problem with the lead in the water is you've consumed it on a daily basis, but not once in your lifetime.
How about you, Roger?
It doesn't track you down.
Absolutely.
You do.
It'll be in my backpack, and I'll take it back and put it in the plant.
Well, you'll recycle it, yeah.
Are there recycling bins, like, in a place like this? And what do you do when there aren't?
There's one downstairs.
You guys, let's just make a decision that we all go up to Jay Leto and say, we need a more aggressive recycling system at our conferences. It's an issue.
Public space recycling is a challenge, and just in having the cost and the infrastructure.
Okay, so. Question from you, and then we'll come
Elizabeth
to
Elizabeth Roy, freelance, and I'm a frequent contributor to National Free Memphis on plastic and waste issues. And I've heard a lot of talk about the quest for a universal plastic. At least in the U.S., these systems are already in place, way more than composting systems, and some people have been telling me that we should move more toward a single type of plastic that has many, all these different properties and that can be perfectly recycled, and there's far more chances of cleaning up waste and dealing with this problem that way than a shift to composting systems which are in their infancy. Have you heard?
I can't imagine, because that's why we use so many different kinds of plastics, because they all have their own properties that make sense for what they're being used for. I mean,
but
this
market differentiation, right? But I guess it's a cultural thing.
No, it's not about market differentiation. It's about the proper use. It's put to, I mean, this is flexible, this is stiff, so this is two different things. You couldn't make a cap out of flexible material. It would
you know,
get off.
It's technically impossible to rearrange the bottles to hold sodas and still water and
I think one thing you have to realize is that every brand has a very specific formula for the plastic that is used to create the materials. So
why don't we force them to use the same system?
Then that would be socialism. I mean, honestly, like we can't. I think what I would rather see instead of focusing in on is there one plastic, and I want there's a fourth R that we have to talk about, which is replace.
Yeah.
A redesign, right? And so rather than putting all that effort, and I think Dow and I think others, they have the engineers, they have the material scientists that can figure out this problem of what is the new material that allows us, even though there will be nefarious things that happen to it, and it, you know, everything will cause damage, but what is the new material that we can agree to that can start to replace some of these plastics? Every one of these plastics has some sort of chemical additive to it as well, right?
Not all.
Some of them do.
Some, yeah. Yeah, but not all.
I'm not looking for bio-based because we don't have enough industrial composting facilities. So I think that's the great fallacy,
right?
But I am
looking
for something.
It wouldn't make anything better, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's no easy solution to this, but I also think
glass.
That there's market forces.
Yeah.
And
there's glass.
Which is heavy, and then what do you do on the airplanes?
And the recycling industry will probably eliminate glass in the collection stream in the next 5 years.
But there's aluminum. But there's aluminum that doesn't have BPA lining, right? And so 75% of all aluminum ever produced is still within the market in comparison to plastic, which is right around 30%.
Wow.
So should we be looking at something that we have where it's high value already, where like in Brazil it's 98% recycled, and the U.S. we're not quite there. We need to increase the value of it. But anything that has value will get recycled, right? Not 100%, but can we look at some of these other materials rather than plastic? Can we look at something else that already has the mechanisms in place to be recovered?
Okay, let me take a question. Katie, and then...
One follow-up.
Yeah.
So instead of having a huge range, which is, you know, we all know the 1 through 7, right?
Yeah.
But really there's subsets by the thousands within that one.
Seven is
other. So even if you took and limited that, I mean, there are values. I think Dune said... it'll get recycled if there's value. Absolutely. So if you have a milk jug, you're talking a range of $140 to $240 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
That material is high value.
Milk jugs.
Those plants were closing in the U.S.
I don't know what myth. More plants are opening now because of China's sword and blue sky. Than ever before. China's investing in U.S. recycling right now because blue sky is the black market recycling going into China. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Shipments of recycling is now black market, and the China's government has called it blue sky.
Yeah.
Because those facilities still need to have that material coming in, and so those products are still clean. Products, because you can imagine what a milk jug that you put in your recycling bin, a week later it got picked up, it got processed, baled, and pending a full truckable, transportable load, spends 2 weeks on the water, spends 2 weeks going through customs and getting opened up. The poor guy who has to open up that door of milk jugs,
Katie,
that's putrid.
Katie.
So my apologies to those who are looking to localize the story. I'm interested in...
Name affiliation.
Oh, I'm Katie Daigle. I work at Science News. But I've been living in India for the past 8 years, and the awareness there is null. Given the population growth, given the economic growth, given the fact that already the majority of plastics is flowing from Asia, what, if anything, is possible to do in terms of stemming that flow? And are there any success stories at this point, this early stage in Asia, that you can share, or kind of a change of mindset or any activism?
Okay. Anybody want to crack at that?
I mean, I can speak directly to within India. So what's interesting is on the Western side, right, what you see is that India has passed the most sweeping legislation of any country as part of the UN Environment Clean Seas campaign. Most of us look at that and say, devil's in the details. Was it a stunt? Is there going to be implementation? But it looks good, right? It looks like progress is going to be made. You also have one guy in Afroz Shah who has been leading the effort to clean up beaches every single day, every single weekend. He goes out and he cleans up the nastiest beaches that you can imagine. When the icon, Ganesh, during that annual ceremony, when Ganesh gets thrown into the water, it's a product that, so they all go out and they pick up Ganesh and they bring him back. What those are Band-Aid solutions, right? So you have a number of entities like Circulate Capital, Next Wave, a few others looking at, can we build infrastructure in India to be able to collect the material, and then can we create demand from global corporations to be able to utilize that material in their products and their packaging? I think that's promising to start seeing that, but how far away are we from it? We're pretty far away, you know? So I think there is a need for more grassroots activism to continue to raise awareness. Indonesia, two girls, Melati and Isabel, bye-bye plastic bags, have been fighting the good fight for a long time. The Indonesians still haven't passed the bag ban that they've been asking for, yet we're holding their ocean conference in just a few weeks in Indonesia and Bali. So we'll see, you know, we'll see what kind of commitment the Indonesians are going to make. So there's a need for a full court press, quite honestly, to be able to continue to raise awareness and to point out incineration is not the option, because it feels like the, you know, carbon sequestration thing, clean coal, all over again. So we have a lot of work to do. But there's like pockets, there's like little glimpses of hope that we look at that allow us to say we feel like we're starting to see some opportunities.
So what we're going to do now is we're technically going long, but this is going well. So let's, if you want, just take one more question against.
I just wanted to know what you thought of at National Geographic, where I work with some folks. We actually Claire Jones. We're having cans that support charitable water efforts in Africa. It's an aluminum can, but if you buy it, I didn't know if you thought there was things that it seems like a good idea. But sometimes I wonder, like, it just seems complex. So I'm buying my water in an aluminum can that will then support water efforts, restoration efforts.
What I have learned through many years of reporting on these issues is that first impression obviously fails. This is a matter of deep digging into life cycle analysis, and the solution that seems so obviously perfect then eventually turns out to be one of the worst. So this is really very difficult to say just by eyesight. This is a serious study. It really needs to look into the materials. Where do they come from? How are they processed? How they are transported? How could they be recycled? Are they recycled? And so on and so on. It's a very difficult task for each and every product, I think.
You also need to ask where the water comes from. So we have evaluated probably 20 different brands, including Just Water, including Box Water, including all the canned water. And there's only one water company that we'll work with that cans in a non-BPA-lined aluminum can with a screw top. That's Open Water. That's the only one that we'll work with. And primarily because most of these companies aren't paying their fair share for the extraction of the water, aren't caring for the replenishment of those water systems, and they're shipping water. Like, there's one company that bottles in Austria and sells in London. that just can't be good. So you have to be really careful too of who you work with, but really pay attention to where the water is coming from these days. I think that's another thing. It's not just the bottle; it's what's in it. Mm. And are we really caring for the environment when we buy bottled water?
Hey Claire, a nice cover, by the way.
Yeah, very nice.
So our terrific panelists, I'm going to ask them to stick around and to answer your questions, too. If you have any other questions for them, or if they have some story ideas to share with you guys, please feel free.